The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is brought to you by A2X Accounting. Thinking about selling your business? Well, chances are your financials aren't in tip-top shape. So you can either spend an insane amount of time going back and cleaning them up to get top dollar for your business, or you can use A2X. A2X will go back and recast years of lump sum payments by Shopify, Amazon, or other platforms to break out everything you probably should have been doing all along. Break out your product revenue, your Amazon fees, your credit card fees, your shipping revenue, and magically put it in the right month, in the right time, in Xero or QuickBooks. It'll give you transparent financials going back years, even if you haven't been keeping up on it. Since 2014, they've been trusted by over 10,000 merchants to help clean up their books and create transparent financials, and they've earned a 4.8 out of 5-star rating in the ECF review directory. So if you want to sell your business for top dollar and avoid the insane amount of pain and hassle with cleaning up your books, learn more at ecommercefuel.com/A2X. The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is brought to you by OneClick Upsell, the largest and most popular upsell app in the Shopify marketplace, trusted by over 11,000 users, over 1,900 Shopify Plus stores. Man, it is hard to get people to your store these days, whether you're doing organic or whether you're trying to get down in the muck that is Facebook ads these days with the disaster that that has become. You want to take advantage when people actually show up. And if you give people a chance, 1 in 6 will spend more money with you if you send them a personalized, targeted, relevant upsell offer, which is what OneClick Upsell makes it super easy to do. You can do it pre-purchase, post-purchase, give them lots of different options. It makes it incredibly easy, and they've helped store owners generate over $200 million in additional revenue. So if you want a slice of that and you want to get started, you can get started really quickly with them in just a few minutes, get your first upsell up and running. Check them out at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping 7- and 8-figure e-commerce brands build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And today, joined by someone who I have had a lot of fun following on Twitter, shares a lot of good stuff, knows the growth space well, knows e-commerce, and that is Jesse Pooji. He started his career at McKinsey & Goldman, launched a growth and marketing agency called AmpPush.com, and now runs Gateway X, which is a holding company that invests in D2C brands and other software, and Growth Assistant, which helps growth teams focus on the 80-20 while getting all the kind of the hard kind of low value stuff off their plates. And it's just a great guy to follow on Twitter in general. Jesse, what is your, I should have had this in my notes. I wasn't even prepared. What's your Twitter handle for those that are obsessed with the platform and want to check you out?
Yeah, it's just my first two initials, J and then S like Sam, and then my last name, P like Peter, U, JJI, JS Pooji.
Perfect. Thanks. Well, thanks for coming on. This is going to be fun. We got a bunch of, I think, geeky, but fun stuff to talk about. And we kind of connected, I don't know, a month ago or so. And I had a great conversation. One thing that stuck out to me about that, I want to kind of start talking about the space around growth and paid and advertising, was talking about all the turmoil in the Facebook markets. And you said something along the lines of like, well, Facebook's just, you know, it's an auction-driven marketplace. And, you know, so if people aren't getting results on Facebook, it's just, you know, it's probably because they either aren't very good or they don't know what they're doing. So I'd love to have you dive into that a little bit, because if that's the case, there's some probably opportunity out there. And it's definitely not the narrative that a lot of people have, you know, either picked up or just listened to. So talk about that a little bit, if you would.
Yeah. I wonder if I'll get roasted for this perspective, but, and it's not meant to be not empathetic. I, you know, let me start by saying that, like, running a business is super hard, and Facebook is a very finicky beast, and it sort of has volatility, and, you know, each and every individual, you know, has their own situation for their business. But with that said, I think, especially for the owners and the founders out there, you know, if Facebook bids out a CPM, and actually, if you look at their public financials, they reveal that CPM, and I think they even break it down by geo and a few other metrics that you can actually look at, and there's publicly available information. And in general, what you've seen, you know, despite all this stuff, is like Facebook CPM is pretty stable, or it's actually up a little bit. And you go, you know, what does that mean? It's like, well, a bunch of people are going to an auction. They're, you know, I think of a Facebook impression as a piece of real estate, and it's just like a little piece of farmland. And everyone's looking at it and going, I think it's worth this much. And then, you know, where that number is, it clears at, and the little farmland sells. And so, you know, one thing I tease a lot of CMOs, I go, don't go to your board and complain Facebook's getting more expensive, and then say CPMs have gone up, because all you're saying is that other marketers are willing to pay more for that plot of land, than I'm willing to pay. And then they go, well, why are they willing to pay more? Well, they're better at farming the land than I am at farming it. They have a better tractor, or, you know, they have better fertilizers or whatever it might be there. But if you complain that the prices of impressions are going up, all you're saying is that other people in the auction are able to get more out of that impression than we are. And so, you know, when you look at those public financials and Facebook, and of course, you know, again, just to be sensitive, like every individual person's CPMs are different based on how that auction works and a bunch of other mechanics, but broadly the CPM is pretty flat. And, you know, we have this metric at Ampush that we developed called APM, which is essentially acquisitions per 1,000 impressions. And it's essentially combining click-through rate and conversion rate into one metric and going, well, you know, again, for every 1,000, you know, or 10,000 impressions I show, how many sales do I get? And we combine them because really that's like, if you think again, it's a piece of land, it's like, what's my crop yield? You know, what do I get out of showing that, you know, showing the impression to so many different people? And oftentimes, you know, if you just think about the way the math works, like if your CPM goes up 10% and your CPA goes up exactly 10%, it means you got no better at APM. It means you didn't get any more yield and you got no more sales for those 1,000 impressions. But if CPM went up, it means that a bunch of other people got better at it. Just like if there was 10 people bidding on that farmland and you know, 8 of them had a better tractor, they could pay a little bit more for the land and still make their margins work. And so where I, you know, what I tell founders to look at it and marketers and CMOs is, hey, you really got to pay attention to that APM metric. How much yield are you getting per 1,000 or per 10,000 impressions? And are you improving that number faster than the marketplace, faster than CPM is growing? And what it does, you know, is it, first of all, everyone goes, whoa, I never thought of that way. Or rarely, you know, rarely people have thought of that way. But when they do start thinking of it that way, they realize my marketing cannot be static. It has to be dynamic, meaning I have to keep trying new things. I have to want to test other things. And, you know, the process of building a business and entrepreneurship is so scary that like a very common thing we'd see at Ampush all the time was we'd go into a business, they're spending $8 million a year on Facebook, which is, by the way, 80% of their total digital marketing spend. And then of that 80%, 80% is going to one creative. And it's like, they're shit scared of pausing it or touching it because it's like, that's the golden goose, right? That's what made the business work. And unfortunately, that hits the ceiling at some point, and that's kind of what ends up happening. So I think, you know, there's a lot, Facebook is still a, I don't know, $180 billion business. They're still serving lots of impressions to lots of people, and lots of people are buying things from Facebook despite all of the challenges of tracking and management. So the challenge to brands out there is, you know, just like when the stock market, you know, stocks are down or whatever, it's like, where is the opportunity and where can you find it? And you know, not everyone's losing money right now in the stock market. Some people are making money. And so it's the same thing in Facebook land.
Let me play devil's advocate just for a minute here. So these, you know, the big changes really hit maybe, let's call it 9 to 10 months ago. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think you know the paid space exponentially better than I do, but kind of saw that disruption with Facebook. And in theory, like in the long term, right, you could definitely make the argument, hey, if people are able to get more juice out of the lemon bidding at a higher rate for the CPM on Facebook, they're just able to do more with that traffic. They're able to make that traffic more, use that traffic more profitably than you are. But like in a short term period, in a 6 to 9 month period, what about the argument that there's just a lot of people who have been reliant on Facebook for so long, and instead of all these other people being able to monetize it more effectively, they just, there's not a great option, or they haven't necessarily explored or built out those options. So they're either just making less money in aggregate, most people, or they are potentially even just, you know, losing some money. Or you look at like just the gross amount of money, the significant amount of money that's coming in on venture-backed companies, just spending. We're in a pretty frothy time right now, though it's might be tapering it. But thoughts on that at all? Because like I look at...
So are you saying that they're buying irrationally? Like they're spending more, they're making CPMs go up even though it's not the right thing, but just because they're using venture dollars? Is that what you're saying? Or you're saying...
Yes, potentially it's a small part, but a bigger part would be they're buying, either it's less profitable than it used to be for most people, and they just kind of have to take it. Because like when I talk to most, I did a survey called E-commerce Trends Report, looking at the data right now, and it's real early. We haven't crunched it all, but some of the early results, like asked how much have you seen overall paid traffic change in terms of the performance across this last year, and the biggest kind of metric in this is Facebook. And the top 5 responses are just like, you know, 20% less effective, 10% less effective, 30% less effective for the top 3. And anecdotally, it just seems like it just seems like Facebook just across the board for almost everyone I talk to isn't doing as well. So
yeah, no, I guess to be clear, let me say a couple things. One is I don't think the venture back thing is really an issue because, you know, yes, there are some people who irrationally spend and just try to scale, but it's very few and far between. So there's, I don't think it's driving the auction broadly. I've seen hundreds of advertisers and they're always thinking about CAC to LTV and what's the margin and am I making money? What's my payback period? So I think that's one, you know, just to kind of dispel that from my perspective, at least, and what I know. And then, yeah, you know, I think people are, the spending can be less effective. And you may be right that people are still bidding the same amount that they're bidding, but it doesn't take away the opportunity to get better at squeezing, you know, to trying, for example. And a lot of this, by the way, the how behind this is like creative testing. And it's like, you know, every business where I'm a part of, we have a roadmap and every week there's, you know, 5 to 10 new creative tests. And every other week there's 2 or 3 new landing page tests. And the reality of it is you have to be in this constant mode in some ways of like, you should be the price maker in that market. You should be like, I'm going to pay the highest CPM because I'm going to get the most juice out of that CPM. And that should be the mindset. So it doesn't really matter. Even if, let's just say what you're saying is true. People are basically, performance has gone down by 20%. And they're just tolerating it. And they're still, they're just tolerating lower margins. That's kind of what you're saying, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Even if it's true, it doesn't take away the fact that Facebook is an $80 billion media marketplace and there's opportunity to buy those impressions and get better bang for your buck out of them. And I think what's ended up happening is, again, people have got pretty paralyzed by it. And there's, you know, what we've seen on our side, on the Ampush side, is creative has become that much more important. You know, changing the campaign structures is super important and broadening everything out versus what we used to be very narrow targeting or forms of narrow targeting. Data is super important. You know, we have the Facebook pixel is challenged. And so we have, our own proprietary pixel, and there's other parts of the business where we're able to then get better data. So there's a way to solve all these things. And again, if I'm a brand, you can be a victim to what's happening, or you can go, wait, you know, everyone else is, they're licking their chops, like they're licking their wounds right now. This is the time. Let me go get in there and I can win. And I think that's sort of, you know, maybe that's the entrepreneur optimist inside me, but that is definitely the mindset I would be bringing to this.
No, that makes sense. Just, yeah, it's not quite as easy to do it, but kind of just, yeah, grow and figure it out. What's changed the most in the growth landscape, setting aside the whole Facebook stuff, which has just been talked about ad nauseum. I'm only contributing to that by asking these questions. But when you look at, you know, 12 to 18 months ago, yeah, what did you see that's changed? Has there been any big changes on the growth landscape, paid and organic, in your opinion, and how you can reach people digitally?
Yeah, I mean the big one, which I think we all know, is TikTok. And, you know, TikTok, you're going to speak from my own experience. You know, I started working with Facebook ads in 2010. So I'm like a grandpa dinosaur. and during that time, I, you know, built an integrated Twitter, built an integrated Pinterest, built an integrated Google, some of Google social stuff that never ended up working, Snapchat. So I've literally seen every one of these ad platforms from their nascency. And I can tell you that TikTok to me feels like the second coming of Facebook. And some of it's because of the scale, but some of it's because of it's unique enough that I think there's something, you know, it's unique enough in terms of format and kind of the way the algorithm works that it feels pretty distinctive. And then there's this third thing about TikTok. Well, and related to that second point is it's algorithmically driven, and Twitter always struggled with that and Snapchat struggled with that. Their algorithms just weren't quite as good as Facebook's. But the third thing I find interesting about TikTok is everyone is there in a commercial, like it feels very open to being commercial. And like Facebook always had this like, oh, privacy. I don't want to be shown an ad. I want to, you know, look at my friends and my family. And TikTok is like, show me random stuff. You know, like I want to see something random. Okay. Yeah. You want to show me a product? Great. Show me a product. And the creators are there. They're somewhat commercial in the way they're trying to get your attention. And so it's an interesting platform in the sense that everyone kind of seems like they're okay being there, you know, for some sort of commercial purpose. And I think that will make it even more, even further along the lines of being a great platform for digital distribution. And, you know, the other thing that's very unique about it is that organic and paid are way more closely related in TikTok than they have been in any other social platform. And, you know, Facebook had this period where everyone was acquiring likes. You know, I kid you not, dude, I've overseen $100 million of likes acquisition. you know, like Samsung, Walmart, people were like, guys, come, we need likes. We'll pay 50 cents a like, just go get us as many likes as you can. And then Facebook threw that all away at some point on everyone, but they thought the organic distribution through the feed, but it never quite tied to paid. It didn't matter all that much. And TikTok has this really unique thing where the organic and what works organically can also work on a paid and vice versa. And you can learn by doing organic and then move it to paid. So I think, you know, that is the biggest. And 18 months ago, just to be clear, to give you a sense of how fast they were working, 18 months ago, I had a call with TikTok. They didn't have a self-serve ad platform. So they are moving at an incredible pace to build that business. And I'm, you know, I'm very bullish on it.
How niche or industry specific is it, obviously? I mean, do you feel like most brands, if they get creative enough, can actually have a meaningful and a profitable presence on TikTok?
Totally.
Or is it really? Okay. So it's not the, we have a boring business kind of excuse. You see people across the spectrum of businesses and products doing well.
Yeah. And look, I think there is something about cracking that code, right? It's not that you can just walk in there and run ads. And I think that's part of what happened with Facebook, by the way, by 2016, 17, is like, you know, marketers got lazy and e-commerce stores, it was easy. You could launch some ads and their algorithm would figure stuff out. And that wasn't, by the way, what it was like in 2013 on Facebook. Like you're talking to somebody who ran Facebook ads before the pixel. I ran ads before there were lookalike audiences, right? I ran ads before there was newsfeed ads. so we had to learn how to make these ads work on Facebook, right? We had to try different things and crazy creative and headlines and try this and target substitute teachers and target people who like Target, you know, like we were coming up with all kinds of ideas for how to make Facebook ads work. And I think TikTok is not the same from a targeting perspective, but it's very similar from a creative perspective, that there's a lot of things you want to be trying and experimenting with. And if you're, you know, you're a mortgage company trying to get mortgages, like there's a different type of dialogue that goes on versus if you're a supplement company versus if you're a furniture company, right? They're all going to be different ways that you tell that story in those narratives. But I very much think it's working and will work certainly across every single vertical.
What are your thoughts on, you know, spicing up creative? You mentioned that with Facebook and for TikTok, of course. And it's apart from the keeping it, you know, I guess there's a couple aspects to it that are obvious. One is you don't want to hit people the same ads. They just get ad blindness. You want to keep it fresh and interesting so it catches their attention. Second time is just testing to see what really resonates, because sometimes you don't know from a creative and a messaging and a copywriting standpoint. Apart from those two things, are there any other thoughts or tips or kind of ideas on really doing your best to optimize creative?
We're talking about for TikTok?
Yeah, for TikTok, Facebook or TikTok, either or.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot, man. There's entertain people, bring value to people, try very weird stuff. Try a 2-second TikTok, you know? Like literally it goes so fast that someone has to go back and look at it. Like the bounds of human creativity are on display on that platform in a way that has never really existed or you know, has been working up to that. And I think of anything and everything, you know, like there's all these memes that go on. And I guess the biggest advice I would give to your listeners and the community of e-commerce Fuel is you gotta start being a user of TikTok. That's where it starts. You know, all my ideas start because I'm on it and I'm using it and I'm connecting dots in my head that will make things that then I come up with an idea and I go to the team, let's try this. And dude, there's such weird stuff there, but like between human ingenuity on display and then their algorithm, like, I literally, there's no bounds. Like, I'll give you a funny example. You know, there's a person who does screenshots of Excel shortcuts. And those Excel shortcuts are in the backdrop of like loud gangsta rap. And guess what? I like Excel shortcuts and I like gangsta rap. So somehow this got served in the algorithm after a week of using TikTok. And now I follow it and I love it. And you know, like, just think about how random that is. And yet it caught me. I was like, this is awesome. And I send it to friends and I'm like, dude, did you know this shortcut? And I'm also like, dude, I love this song. Like, it's just, I mean, that's TikTok. And so in that sense, just think how powerful that is.
The absolute pinnacle of nicheness. Total random geek side question here between finance folks. Did you, early in your finance career, did you have someone who came to you at one point and like unplugged your mouse or like set, you know, sat over you and hit your hands with a ruler every time, you know, you used your mouse? Was there someone in your life, because there was for me, someone that was like, no, you're doing it wrong. You're going to slow down. You're going to have a horrible, painstaking 3 or 4 days, and then you're going to fly in the clouds. Did you have that experience, or did you come to it naturally?
Yeah, I had an interesting version of that experience. So I went to Penn and I went to Wharton undergrad. And if you look at the keyboards inside of a Wharton lab, all of the F1 keys are gone because nobody wants to accidentally hit it and then like screw up the speed of their shortcuts. And the escape key is like worn down. So like it was beaten into me in college because it's such a like finance prep school that it was like, hey, dude, you don't touch your mouse. And, you know, these are the shortcuts. And like there's classes that teach it to you and there's contests, like you name it, you know.
That's awesome. I wish I would have had it that early. Well, let's talk a little bit about affiliate because your early days, I believe, kind of going back to your roots, you know, affiliate marketing was one of the ways that you really got into, I believe, got into and cut your teeth with paid ads and acquisition and things like that. And we talked a little bit before we started recording, but on the e-commerce front, when I think about store owners that I know that have grown meaningfully through affiliate, very, very few, sub 1%, I would say even, in terms of that was the, you know, a core driver of their business. But you think it's a, you know, you think it's a really good opportunity and potential, you know, acquisition path for store owners. So I'd love to hear you talk about that kind of affiliate in 2022.
Yeah. I mean, totally. I see there's so many publishers out there, both big and small, and then also creators who are trying to do anything they can to monetize their audiences. And you know, the beauty of it is oftentimes the right types of publishers are willing to take risk because they'll make a higher effective CPM from a publishing perspective. And so you can go to them and say, hey, let's do this on a CPA deal, make sure the CPA, and then as an advertiser, as an e-commerce business, you get, you know, guaranteed economics. You don't have to worry about your CPA fluctuation with Facebook. And it's variable paid. It's not, you know, you're not just spending $1,000 a day on media and hoping it backs out. It backs out from moment one. And so it's great, you know, and it works like a charm. And I think the reason that people don't do it and the reason they light up Facebook is because, man, affiliate is hard. Everyone's like, what's the secret? How do you do it? I'm like, there's no secret. I'll plug Growth Assistant. You know, now it's like, well, hire a Growth Assistant in the Philippines and all he or she does is reach out to 50 publishers every day. And say, this is our product. This is what we do. We'd love to pay you a 30, you know, and then send them a second message. And like, there's just no way to build it other than like literally pound paving, you know, obviously you can get some of these third-party platforms that will find you some affiliates. But generally speaking, the way to do it is to just go find these creators and these affiliates and set those deals up. And so, you know, you have to add up a bunch of publishers who maybe send you one or two customers a day. And there's some bigger ones, obviously. But like then in aggregate, though, if you do it really well, you create this super unfair advantage in terms of acquisition. And so, you know, I'm really big on affiliate and it's, you know, the risk model, the variableness of it, like it's such an attractive thing. It just requires a lot of elbow grease.
Yeah. Bring it in house, kind of just getting down in the trenches. Do you have a platform or something that do you manage all of that through Excel and through just UTM tracking for attribution for when people send clicks your way and for sales? Or how that seems like, apart from just the outreach and the identification, the logistics, the tracking, attribution seem like that would also be so much of the kind of overhead that you have to, that makes it hard. So how do you manage all of that?
Yeah. I mean, we use a third-party platform, Impact Radius. It's just a software that makes all the tracking and tagging. I think they're good. Tune is good. There's a bunch of, the third-party management of it or the software is easy, the easy part, right? The hard part is setting a goal for the team and saying, I want 10 new affiliates or creators a week. And to get 10 new affiliates, it means you have to reach out to probably 200 and follow up with all 200 and then shepherd a call with them and convince them. Like you're selling them on featuring you. And any other approach short of that is everyone does it. Someone said to do affiliate. They get three or four publishers. That's fine. It works. And they go, how do I scale this? I don't know. Let me go spend more money on Facebook.
Got it. I think that's a good segue into leadership. One thing that I've often said, yeah, I think leadership's the hardest part of business. It's something I feel like I have a really long way to go in terms of growing. I think it's probably one of the bottlenecks for business, just, you know, for me, because I'm not as good as I could be. And you've written a lot on Facebook about it, a lot of things that have been helpful, I found fascinating. For context for folks, how many people do you have in the companies that you run right now to give people a sense of kind of the team that you're managing and leading?
Yeah, sure. So my leadership journey, you know, we started Ampush as three former college roommates who had worked in kind of finance and consulting. And then, you know, Ampush grew in 2010, it's probably six people. And, you know, peaked in 2016, it was probably 200 people. And then we actually started bringing down the headcount a little bit. And so by the time I left as CEO, it was probably 100 to 150, depending on, you know, contractors and employees and all that stuff. So that's sort of, I guess that's the biggest company I've ever, you know, in terms of headcount and size today. You know, I'm sort of playing this, I'd call it like chairman-y type role across a variety of different things, but the organization's range, you know, their Ampush is still there and I'm the chairman of Ampush, but that's, the rest of them are probably like 3 people to 20 people, the different kind of businesses that I'm involved in.
And do you, so chairman, a lot of those, not necessarily in the day-to-day, but maybe safe to say you kind of, you know, on the board as a chairman or connecting directly with the CEOs or managers. So is that kind of how you're approaching most of your leadership role right now, is kind of guidance, mentorship, oversight, things like that?
Yeah, I'd say I'm playing like a founder and chairman role for the 3 new ventures, like that are, as a part of Gateway X, right? So Gateway X is a venture studio. We've launched 3 companies in the last year. One's an e-commerce brand, one is a SaaS business for e-commerce businesses, and one's like a services outsourcing business. Those are the 3. And I'm sort of playing the founder and chairman role, which means like I am the guy going like, let's get the website up and let's get this thing cranking. Okay, how do we sell it? You know, like, so I'm very involved in that context. But then when it comes to the day-to-day stuff, I've plugged in kind of CEO, GM folks in each of them. That's really, okay, what's the plan for the week? What's going to get done? How's it going to get done? Who's doing what? And then I'm obviously coaching and mentoring those people quite closely.
Got it. And how do you, I feel like that is such a, there's a lot of people in e-commerce fuel that hear that and they say, I want one of those people. I want one of those CEOs, general managers that's incredibly, that can take that vision and execute it and manage a team well. I think the hard part from my conversations with folks is that to find someone like that, that is also not running their own thing, to bring them in-house is difficult. And maybe it's just a vision compensation and maybe an equity play as well. But how do you find great people like that, that that can take what you want to do and run with it with the team? Because it's such an ultimate leverage tool, but finding them is the linchpin.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, look, I would not claim to have it figured out by any means. So I feel straight. I mean, I could just tell you, you know, like I could tell you what I've done so far and, you know, tell you what, like, you know, Growth Assistant is being run by like a friend of mine for 25 years. We were in 7th grade pre-algebra together and, you know, she was itching to do something entrepreneurial, had never started a company. She had a background in HR and operations and recruiting, which is a big part of that business. And it just worked, you know. And then the GM of Unbloat, which is our supplement brand, you know, he was, I found him through like the McKinsey alumni database and he had done some e-commerce stuff and done some GMing, but he had been in the public sector for a few years and was ready to kind of do something more startup-y. And then the third person he's starting on Monday actually to be the GM of Kahani, which is our SaaS business. You know, he started a couple of ventures. He was working in like at a 10-person SaaS business and he actually relocated from Boston to St. Louis and found me through Twitter and was like, and you know, he had started some companies, he had run some parts of teams and he hadn't quite again done the full CEO founder thing. And so, you know, I guess in each, what might be similar is like, I do think there's a thing of you have to be willing to bet on people's potential. You know, that's definitely something that's big for me. Like I'm definitely all about trajectory versus knowledge. Like none of these people had experience running the business that they are now running with me. You have to have really clear agreements with that person, you know, about who makes the final call and how that call is made and you know, what sorts of things. Like there's tons, you have to have very clear agreements. You can't, there's no room for passive aggressiveness or no room for, you know, 2 in the box. Like you really have to get tight and clear. And when I say clear, I mean regarding marketing, regarding Twitter, like who does this? Who chooses this? When does this happen? How does this happen? Like I'm very tight on my agreements and what I call integrity. It's not like moral integrity, but integrity around we do what we say when we do, you know, when we say we'll do it. And then you have to be ready to coach and jump in. And that's part of the agreements, which is like, I make it okay for someone to say, you know what, Jesse, like Growth Assistant Adrian, she's like, she doesn't know how to do Twitter marketing. And why would she? And it's okay that she doesn't know that. I'm like, great, that's what I'm there for. Now I'll own that part while you go do this, right? And so you have to make it, you have to be really be willing to let people be vulnerable and be vulnerable yourself and find kind of the win-wins. And so it's a real, you know, there's and you're coaching them and teaching them and be willing to make them better and give them candid feedback and they're willing to hear the candid feedback, right? So there's a lot of, the devil's a lot in the details around how you're working with another person and what they're coming into. And so, yeah, I mean, those are some thoughts. Again, I would not, give me 10 years and if I figure it all out and then I'd come back and write a book or something, but that's what I've done so far.
No, that's good stuff. So all 3 of those rules that you mentioned, it sounds like either they were, you didn't, correct me if I'm wrong, but you didn't go out and post a job and have applicants come in and try to filter. You either people reached out to you, and you saw something in them, or there were people you already knew that you recruited into the role. So you were more or less tapping your existing network to fill those roles versus trying to cast a wide net and you know, figure out which fish was going to be the most delicious. Maybe that's
I think that's right. Yeah. I think the most job posting one was the McKinsey kind of alumni database, but even then you're searching in a very specific pond. So to use your analogy, like you're not in the ocean, you're in a very fertile, good pond with really capable people and smart people. And so, yeah, I think that's right.
Hey, Andrew here with a little aside. If you're listening, you're obviously interested in e-commerce. And so I want to make sure you know about our private community for 7- and 8-figure e-commerce brands at E-Commerce Fuel. And the secret sauce, like you might guess, is it's limited to people who own stores, who are in the trenches, practitioners doing this stuff. It's a very curated community, which has three big benefits. First, it means everyone inside can help get fast, on-point answers to your most important questions. If you're trying to decide if SMS is a tool worth rolling out, if you just got suspended on Amazon, if you're trying to hire a director of e-commerce, these are all things that either people have experience with or have gone through in the forums. And if you post and ask questions, you'll get answers within hours, sometimes even minutes, as well as being able to tap into close to a decade of archive discussions. So you get a lot of insights, fast answers to pressing questions. You get to plug into an amazing network of over 1,100 experienced e-commerce entrepreneurs. So you can reach out to people. If you're in E-Commerce Fuel, our members are incredibly giving and generous. And so if you want to reach out to someone with expertise, oftentimes they'd be happy to share what they know. If you're, you know, traveling, hopefully when traveling is a common thing again, a lot of our members would hit in the city, you know, DC, Dallas, Sydney, Australia, you know, London, wherever it is, and be able to have someone on the ground you can connect with or maybe grab a beer with. It's an amazing network. And then finally, we've got a huge user-generated review library with over 10,000 reviews on agencies, software, e-commerce software that you can tap into to avoid costly hiring and software mistakes. Nothing is worse than spending 3 months with an agency to onboard only to find out that a bunch of people already tried them and they were horrible and they wasted a bunch of your money and your life. So those are the kind of things you can avoid tapping into the unbiased reviews and experiences of our members with our software directory. So if any of this sounds interesting to you, you should join us at ecommercefuel.com. You can learn more. You can apply for membership there. We also have a 5x ROI guarantee. If you own a 7- or 8-figure brand and your membership fees for our community don't pay for themselves at least 5 times over the course of the first year, we'll refund it completely as well as send you $1,000 just for the wasted time. So ecommercefuel.com, check it out. We'd love to have you apply and potentially join the community. All right. Back to the discussion. What's a role? It could be one that is really just helps you be more productive, or it could be a role that helps one of the companies that you own. What one or two roles do you wish you would have hired and brought on board way sooner than you did? When you got it, you're like, I cannot believe I waited 4 years to hire for X.
Oh man, there's so many. I mean, the biggest one I'd say is like a people and ops type person. Which can range all the way from like office manager who like helps with certain operational things in the office, but you know, or on Zoom or whatever, but also takes care of the people and is there kind of as a first line of defense. You know, one thing I tell a lot of founders and business owners, I say, listen, your business is your baby, right? And so if your star growth marketer comes to you and is upset and wants to complain, they just want to vent and complain most 80% of the time. Right? They want to just talk to someone. They're frustrated by certain things. And I know at least for me, especially when I was younger, I would freak out, right? I'd be like, oh my God, like I'd text my wife maybe it was my girlfriend. And I was like, oh my God, this guy's going to quit. Like, I'm so scared. Like, what are we going to do? Right? And the reality of it is that person just wanted to, and by the way, like I'd say, okay, new initiative. We need to, you know, like everyone can take an hour off every day to meditate, whatever. Like you start doing this, you'd be very reactive, or I was very reactive to these things. And the reality of it is, you know what, that person wanted to walk around the block with someone and vent and feel heard. And some of it is I've gotten better at hearing people and just say, okay, I hear you. Like, I get it. And I, you know, it doesn't mean I'm going to do anything about it or I may or may not. But I think the value of a people ops beyond the obvious, like make hiring easier, make the office more professional. Like that's a ton of value. But the biggest thing is like emotional leverage for the founder or owner. Because if you have a staff of 20 and 3 people are doing that a week, like it, at least for me and a lot of, you know, younger founders or you know, it can take a lot out of you. And if you have a great people or ops person, they'll go have those conversations. And then look, they'll synthesize signal to you. They'll go, hey, you know what? I think you're being a little tough on this issue. And I think you really need to simmer down on it. Or, hey, this thing, I think we should provide this benefit for everyone. And so the value of that person, both kind of running interference is like one that I think is hired way. Like I have lots of friends who are founders who are like, we're 40 people. And I'm like, and they don't have that person yet. I'm like, dude, you know, and they're like, yeah, it's terrible. Like it's hard. And I get it. Like I understand why.
One thing you've talked about is the importance of having company history and lore and story and tradition and just how important that is to building culture and getting people on board and understanding the past and the you know, where the company's come from. Can you talk a little bit, if you have an example of from one in your, you know, either past or current companies of how that looks and how that's played a role?
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, we had and have a ton of it at Ampush. You know, one of my favorite, I have a couple of examples of this. You know, one of my favorite quotes, I would do, you know, every, while I was CEO, I would do every single new hire orientation on the first day. I would be the first touch point, you know, tell the story about the whole business and even just like pause at certain parts and people would be like, wait, you guys were only 25 or 26 when you started it. And most of the people we're talking to are that age, you know, or maybe a year or two earlier than that. And so for them, they go, whoa, that's cool. You know, like you were that young when you started the business. And it creates just sort of a baseline. And then I love my favorite, one of my favorite entrepreneurship quotes of all time is the Steve Jobs one where he says, you know, everything in this world was built by people no smarter than you. And when you realize that, like, you're never the same. And you know, because you grow up and like, I think of this as like the roads that are paved and the buildings and the skyscrapers. When you actually realize, like I was as a kid and you grow up, you go, oh, wow, there's skyscrapers and there's roads and there's cars. And then you go, wait, that was all made by people, you know? And that was like very profound for me. And so I tell that on the first day to folks that are starting. And, but then I go, but you know what? Let's put this, the word Ampush in there. Everything that you see at Ampush, because, you know, when you join a company that's 100 people, that's been around for 5 years, you go, oh yeah, they worked with Uber and people would walk in and they don't necessarily come in feeling empowered. And I go, I'd say everything here was built by people like you, by 20, you know, 23, 24 year olds doing growth marketing. And then I actually would have a specific list. So I'd say, so-and-so, this thing that you think is our methodology for optimization, so-and-so built that. This thing that is, you know, our software system that you use internally for data, this is the names of the people who built that. And so, you know, I do my best to really say like, hey, everything here has been built by people. And then you can go, you know, you can go build these things too as you grow and scale the business. So that was like, you know, some of the big things we do to motivate and kind of from a get-go. And then, you know, the other category I'd throw in here just related to lore and stuff is like, you know, we have just like funny stories, right? I mean, we have funny stories of like the early days of the company. We have funny stories of like offsites and when weird stuff happened and crazy stuff happened. We have like weird, like during the pandemic, there was like a client who dropped their towel in the middle of a call and they thought their thing was off and like fully bared themselves to like our whole. So there's just like, you know, you want that kind of stuff traveling around because it bonds people and it brings people together and you want to encourage, this is what people are spending their life on. You want them to feel like there's, you know, there's like a fun, there's like the fun bondingness of that that comes from it. We have a lot of funny stories. Like we have one, another one, this one's slightly offensive to me, but still kind of funny. Like in the early days of Ampush, we were in this like San Francisco building and kind of not a great part of town. And our office was all the way in the back of like kind of an empty building. And so typically we'd bring in a candidate and we'd show them the office and then we'd move them to these conference rooms, which were not near our office. So they were like, basically imagine conference rooms inside of a totally open warehouse, these random, and they're rooms and they're like, they're windowless rooms, right? This is like early startup days. And we had this, like, we were actually looking for this ops HR people person. And we had three women show up at the same time. And, you know, we were really busy that day. So I quickly just like brought them upstairs and put them all in different rooms. And, you know, I went to go interview my woman and someone else interviewed the other person that we were just going to do a swap. And then my co-founder came in and he goes, hey, like no one's in my room. And I go, that's strange. And so I go, give me a second. We walked out to the room and the application I had given the woman was on the floor, like almost like she had run out. And so Nick, my co-founder, texts or emails her and is like, hey, you know, I'm not sure what happened. And she goes, that was the scariest interview process of my life. You guys walked me into a place. There was no office there. You put me in a, like a room And then they got a little like racist in my opinion. She's like, I thought you were going to behead me.
Oh, jeez. And like, she just sprinted and left.
We never saw her again. But like, we tell that story. That's a funny story. I mean, you know, these stories, that's part of the lore, is just like, that's a funny story, you know? Like,
yeah, that's crazy. You do a really good job about, I mean, obviously touched on Twitter already. Incredible job growing that. And I want to get into the actual, you know, growing that platform or growing a following there and advertising on there in just a second. But you've got, you're producing content, you're writing about things, you're creating things and putting them out there, as well as leading large team, number of companies. And I, that's something I've always, you know, I feel like, especially more recently, trying to think through, how do you juggle those two things as a kind of the maker versus manager mindsets? You know, is it always important to stay on that, you know, putting out content and thinking about those kind of things, but it becomes more difficult the more people that you have and you're leading. So how do you think about that? Like, what percentage of the time do you spend really trying to cultivate and create content and think about ideas and maintain that edge of your craft, while also having time to lead your team well? How's that tension work? And do you prioritize one or the other? Because I feel like that's a challenge for a lot of people, myself included.
You know, I got kind of lucky, honestly. Like, I stepped away from the day-to-day of Ampush and 2 years ago to the month, like in March of 2020, unrelated to COVID, like just bad timing or weird timing. And I moved to St. Louis, which is where my wife and I grew up, and I kind of took most of 2020 off. So I had this really beautiful reset period and I didn't have much to do. And even if you came a year ago, which I think I started tweeting on April 1st officially, like if you looked at me a year ago, I had no employee, you know, I was the chairman of Ampush, but I had no employees and I kind of had nothing going on for the good part of 6 months, at least maybe 8 months. Right. And it was one of the things I was like, oh, like I should start this tweeting. Like, you know, this is a good time to start this. Let me start to do it. And really, like I'd say I got it going before I had new responsibilities and new companies. And that was a real lucky gift or whatever, right? Like, I don't know. I wasn't able to do that when I was running Ampush. Like, I wasn't able to create that time and get that gear for it. And so then, like, and partly because I didn't think it was going to be that valuable. And so it was kind of an interesting situation where I started doing it prior to having a lot of things going on and responsibilities. Now, fast forward like a year and I've got three new companies and, you know, bunch of different things going on. But I think the other thing is I've seen the value of it by having a chance to do it. And so, you know, today I'm the only way I've been able to maintain it is A, I have some help. So I have an awesome person, Michael, who I work closely with, and he's helpful at like augmenting me. We've tried like ghostwriting. It's never worked. Like when he writes stuff for me, it just doesn't work in the same way, but he's really good at helping me get organized, synthesizing stuff out of my brain. And then I've put like 2 hours on my calendar every Wednesday morning. And all I do is I do like writing for Twitter. And it turns out that like I can, if I know that's coming and I'm always writing a thread in my head anyway, you know, in the shower or whatever. And then it's like, I can sit down, I can just, you know, jam two things out as fast as I, you know, raw and get them out. Then like from there, we can kind of shape them up and get them to a good place. So that's sort of what I've done to maintain. And then by the way, I also, you know, on the ongoing basis daily, I use it. Like I like it. I learn stuff. I meet people. So it's not like it feels additive to what I'm doing. It doesn't feel like another thing or different. Like it's a place where I've met candidates. It's a place where I've learned new things about TikTok. Like, so because I learn from it and I use it, it really has become a priority for me.
Talk about just a little bit about Michael who helps you. What does he do? What does that look like? Do you just sit down and, because I agree with you. I feel like I've seen a lot of instances of bad copywriting or excuse me, ghostwriting where someone's writing, their total tone changes on a platform where you just know it's not them. And it's tone is such a difficult thing to nail. I think I would say it's almost impossible, but how does he help you with that? Is it,
I think the best thing to think of him is like an editor, you know, and an organizer, maybe like but I'd say like, just to be clear, you know, like he did not start working with me until August or September of 2021. So from April, like, the journey was, you know, I had, I don't know, 1,500, 2,000 followers. I knew I was going to launch this podcast with Patrick O'Shaughnessy. So the day I was on his, so I was first a guest on his podcast. Then I became a host on the new one called Business Breakdowns. I had sort of said, all right, I'm going to start tweeting. And so leading to that, and this is what I tell everyone, I didn't just start writing threads. Like you see people with 500 followers and not, you know, not hating on them, but they start writing threads and it's like, you know, a tree falls in the forest and no one hears it. I always tell people, like, first you gotta, you know, get into the community, follow more people, comment on interesting threads, add value. Like someone should read. So I was getting, I don't know, two followers a day from comments I was writing. like, oh, when we did this for Uber, this is what we learned. And when we saw this, this is what we did. And I saw my, you know, slowly but surely the following started growing, getting some DMs. And then on April 1st, I sort of wrote that first thread on the back of that podcast. Obviously, it was a good bump to, you know, be on Patrick's podcast. And then from there, I said, okay, I'm going to just start writing different stuff. I'm going to write stories, you know, stories about the Ambush journey. I'm going to write random things I learned. One time I read this memo by Jeff Bezos about space and I summarized it. And like some things did really well and some things didn't. And, you know, it's a little random. One topic I love hearing about, this is when it started to really crack, is I was like, I love hearing about bootstrap companies no one's ever heard of that are like massive and like the stories behind them. And so I found this, the first one I ever did was Epic Software, which is this woman in Wisconsin. And I was like, I've heard that story from three different people. I was like, oh my God, I'm gonna like write this. Let me write a thread on this. And that kind of went crazy. And that was like, okay, cool. And then so Michael's, you know, he started helping me research new stories. He'd give me all the data and a couple of the articles, and then I'd write the thread. So that's an example of like, we did this big series last year of Bootstrap Giants. You know, one time I was like in Cancun with my family, waiting in line and like frustratedly waiting in line for something at this resort that was too packed. And I started writing this one about how the Facebook, you know, this thing people always say, Facebook's listening to you. And I'm like, no, it's not. And I just remember I've explained this to a million people and I'm like, I don't know, let me try writing this. I literally wrote it on my phone on vacation and it was like 10,000, you know, like or whatever. It just became this huge, huge thread. And so that's the other thing is like, it's not, you know, there's definitely things like my favorite story. One of my favorite stories about my entrepreneurial career, I've written it three times in different threads and no one has ever gave a shit about it. And so, you don't really know what works, but you just kind of keep trying it. And then he helped me take some of the things that were working very regular, like the Bootstrap Giants, some of the Ambush stories. He was also good at like, he would just record me talking about a subject and then help me turn it into like more bite-sized tweets. So he's done stuff like that.
The newsletter functionality you have that Twitter has, I think you can click it and more or less automatically puts that person on your email list. Is that something that you see a lot of opt-ins for? Is it a pretty effective tool of growing an email news list or not? So is it just kind of average?
I think so. I mean, I don't know much about newsletters. I think I have about 3,000 subscribers, but I obviously have like 100-something thousand. I don't know if that's good or bad, but it seems to be good. I mean, it seems to work.
Yeah. I'd love to hear your thoughts on Gateway, which is, you know, all the stuff that you're doing here, you know, Gateway, Growth Assistant, and the Business Breakdowns podcast. But talk first, if you would, about Gateway. You guys are investing in D2C companies and helping launch them. Give people an idea of, yeah, what you guys do over there, what your investing thesis or startup thesis is, and just kind of the lay of the land.
Yeah. So the website is like somewhat purposely vague and sort of random. And it's at this point, it's over a year old and probably very much deserves a facelift and an update. You know, I spent this 6-month period just kind of contemplating what was next for me. And, you know, let me back up actually. Prior to that, I started working with executive coaching and leadership coaching. And, you know, that's probably outside of having children, that's probably the most profound thing that's changed my life in the last 5 years. And so, you know, one of the things I did with my coach and there's, I could go talk about coaching forever, but one of the things I did was really like spend a lot of time on this concept of zone of genius, you know, and the idea of zone of genius is like, what is the thing? It's a little bit like the classic, like what was the thing you would do to not get paid for? What's the thing when no one's paying, you know, when you're not on the clock, you do naturally, but really it's the intersection of strengths you have, like strengths and skills, you know, things that don't feel like work and like maybe things that really give you energy that really like you feel energized by doing them. And for me, I realized like that was, I loved the process of like when I'm in my total euphoria is when I'm like, think I've discovered an idea or an opportunity other people haven't figured out. And I'm like putting the pieces of it together to make it a reality. Like that was a big one. That's one. Another one was like my answer to the question of if you weren't an entrepreneur, what would you be as a professor? Like I love teaching. I love coaching. I love synthesizing. And then the third one for me was like, you know, the relationships, like the way you and I met, like I just like to meet other people and I learned so much and it's such a value enhancing thing in my life. And I kind of asked the question, I was like, what business could I build that would let me live those three things forever? Like that's what I want to do till I'm dead, right? And as I looked around, it became clear. And like, I've obviously like looked at Berkshire Hathaway and I've looked at, but it became clear, like, I was like, oh, should I buy businesses? I'm like, I don't know, that won't quite do the first one. Like, should I? And it became clear that like this venture studio model was very much an idea or opportunity to do something like that. And so that's really like Gateway X was very much born from what I think I'm passionate about, which are those three things. And it's not a specific vertical or a product or anything, but it's that way of being. And I started by like kind of open-ended, what should I do? Should I buy these brands? I've obviously invested in a bunch of brands, so I have them listed there, but that's not kind of theoretically part of Gateway X. And then we just started building businesses. And I also realized like, gosh, I don't even have a distinctive orientation towards which business I like better or worse. Like, and I, you know what? I stopped worrying about what was right. Cause that used to worry me all. It was, wait, everyone says SaaS is the best business. Okay. Must do SaaS. And I was like, I don't want to do SaaS. I want to launch a supplement business. And that led me to, you know, like, so I kind of trusted myself, trusted my energy. And I have three completely different, you know, they have overlap between the three of them, but they're all completely different. One is a B2C, you know, D2C brand. One is a SaaS business, and one is like a services outsourcing business. And I think the next one will be something totally even like, I have a few ideas, but I think I was like, okay, this is what I want to do. And like, if now can I make it successful? That's a different question, but I think I know what I want to do with my life. So it's just a kind of a matter of doing it. So it's a venture studio. I'm essentially the founder of every business, you know, in the partnership model we talked about earlier. And we're going to launch, I think I launched too many last year. So, you know, one to two a year, you know, and hope they can turn into something. And then we're also going to, you know, I haven't fully figured this out, but the plan is to hold them. So like, it's kind of a holding company too, but it's a holding company of our own profitable bootstrap businesses. That's how we're thinking about it.
Interesting. Where did you find, from an executive coach standpoint, is there a certain company that you went through to do that? Or did you, how did you find a great executive coach?
I just asked other entrepreneurs, and then I kind of ran across, like, we met four or five different coaches. This was several years ago, but you know, we had a little matrix we made in our head after meeting these coaches. Like, one on one side was spiritual coach versus business coach, you know, like, which one did we want? And then the other one was like experienced, like, you know, entrepreneur versus like professional coach. And we wanted someone who was more like just slightly more spiritual than business. Like, we didn't want a consultant. We didn't want someone who's going to tell us how to structure our org. We wanted someone who's going to like help us look inside and learn, but also had business acumen and could relate to what we were doing. And we wanted someone who had been an entrepreneur and sort of had lived that life, not someone who had been a professional coach. Not that there's anything wrong. That was just what we wanted. And we found this awesome, you know, Dave Cashin is like one of my great friends now, but he ended up, we met four or five, and then we just picked one based kind of on those criteria.
Totally. I mean, you mentioned in that kind of what you really love to do, teaching, you love to teach. Do you get, as a fellow father and someone else who enjoys teaching a lot, I feel like some of the most fun I have in my life is teaching my kids stuff, like whether it's Mount St. Helens or nuclear reactors or just anything, watching them learn stuff and grow. Like, do you have that same, given the overlap, is that kind of the same for you? Like, I could spend hours teaching my kids about stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the funny things about sometimes teaching them is like the best way to teach them is to say, shut up and just let them do what they're about to do, you know, and they may scrape their knee or something like, so that's a big one I've been learning. Both my kids are super curious, and like, now you have YouTube. So it's like, there's almost no question I can't answer. Like what is steel and how does steel get made? Like, I can find that out for you. And then like we do, you know, in addition to story time every night, they get to pick a short video. And so like, we'll just pick something like, oh, steel manufacturing. And like, and then so it's funny, I'm actually learning a ton by their curiosity. And then when they're in the mood, you know, and they ask a question and they want me to explain, I love teaching them stuff. And I try to manage a little bit of the lecturing and the philosophizing, although sometimes I think I don't do enough of it. Like, I maybe need more values in the house, or because I try to kind of just show it versus tell it, but sometimes I think I should tell it more.
No, I love the YouTube on the couch. We've got many hours under the belt of those. Same thing. It's so fun to just, I mean, I learn almost as much, if not as much as they do. Talk about Growth Assistant a little bit. You guys, what do you do for growth teams there? And is it because it's a cool business?
Yeah. No, it's a, you know, it all kind of started with my first job, which was at McKinsey. And, you know, you get in there after 3 to 6 months and you're making a slide. And my manager looks over my shoulder. He goes, why are you doing this? I go, what do you mean? He goes, we have teams in India who do this. I go, really? He goes, yeah, just draw on a piece of paper what you want them to make, send them the information, and then they'll make the slide for you overnight. You send it to them at night and you wake up in the morning. And I go, wow, this is pretty cool. And you know, part of it was like, it gave me a lot of leverage. And they had the same thing for research or data requests. Like, if you needed data, you know, as a young analyst in New York, kind of like, you know, I had all this like leverage at my fingertips. And so when I started Ampush, you know, one of the first things when we started running ads on Facebook was there was no bulk upload tool or power editor or anything like that. To make an ad on Facebook, you had to write the headline. You had to upload the picture, like each ad at a time. And so my head goes, oh, wait, you know, let me create like offshore capabilities. And so we started literally from the first year we were in business, we had a small offshore team, and we were leveraging them with all these processes. They were helping with reporting. I mean, it was obviously extremely cost effective, right? And so Ampush, that team, you know, is probably about 50 people today. We built it ourselves. We trained them. We know how it works. And, you know, over time, we'd have a lot of alums from Ampush who would move on to brands, and they go in-house essentially, right? And the first, I'd get emails from them within 6 months. Hey, can I use the offshore capability? And I'm like, no, you may not. Like, that's a part of our value add. But like, but are you trying to tell me there's nothing that can do that out there? They're like, nope. And it got said enough times that I'm like, okay, this is a good idea. And so that's like essentially what Growth Assistant is it's, you know, we have the team a year ago was 5 people in the Philippines. Today it's 150. Like, I think it'll be 500 in a year. We have a huge number of growth marketers there. We, you know, we're recruiting them, training them, and then we embed them inside of the brand. So they're not, one really important distinction is it's sort of this embedded full-time model. Like, they work as an extension of the team. They're not, you know, they're not going, it's not going through us. It's not going through a project manager who then fishes the work out. It's that human on their team who learns and grows. And one of the funny parts about building a business, a cool synergy that Gateway X is, you know, I'm not the largest anymore. For a while, I was the largest Growth Assistant customer. Now I'm probably like fifth largest, but I have like 6 of these people. And every time I come up with a new way of using them, like affiliate outreach or like aggregating reporting or like whatever, like I have a million examples, a new creative person who can iterate our creative. I literally like turn it into a little case study and I hand it to Adrian. I'm like, hey, tell people they can do this now with their Growth Assistant. And so it's like the demand for that business has really blown my mind. Like, it's a great lesson that, like, one thing I've learned from it is like, when you're an entrepreneur in your first business, like with Ampush, and I'm sure a lot of the community here, you know, you tend to be one-to-one with your business. Like, you are your business, you are your results. And it's really, really hard to dissociate yourself from that. And so one of the nice things about starting multiple businesses is seeing like, no, I'm actually not. Like, this is a puzzle and I have to figure out what people want and deliver it to them and make, you know, can I sell it for more than it costs me? And like, I can see across these three businesses, different types of demand and profiles. And it's made me a lot more being like, oh yeah, this was just a really good, we found a good idea at the right time and it's taken off. This other thing, like, no, that wasn't as demanded for what was the reason for that. So it's made me be a little bit more divorced from the like identification with an individual business. It's been easier.
Yeah. Or I didn't execute as well as I could have. That's obviously
a huge
part of it, but a massive part about it is if you're getting the offering right. Jesse, this has been super fun. Thank you. If you're listening, gateway.xyz in terms of his portfolio, growthassistant.com, if you're doing way too much of the, you know, stuff that you shouldn't be doing and want to free up some of your time. And of course, if you're on Twitter, if you've got a little bit of the Twitter addiction, like so many of us, that's @J as in Jesse, SPUJJI is his handle. Really enjoyed having you on. Thanks for making the time to come and look forward to seeing what happens with Gateway and everything else in the future.
Yeah, appreciate you having me on.
The fact that you've stuck around through that much e-commerce nerding out and geekery tells me you just might be a good fit for the e-commerce fuel community. It's the largest group of 7- and 8-figure store owners on the planet, and it's a packed, active discussion board, multiple live events throughout the year, and so much more. So if that kind of sounds interesting, you should check it out, learn more, and consider applying for membership at ecommercefuel.com. Also, big thanks to One-Click Upsell from Zipify Apps. Rapidly increase your average order value by offering targeted high-converting upsells. You can get started at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. And also A2X, saving you hours of wasted time and frustration by making e-commerce reconciliation easy. Learn more at ecommercefuel.com/A2X. Thanks so much for listening. Work hard, adventure often, and I'm looking forward to seeing you again next Friday.
The ASY Radio Network, live from New York.